This hour is a paid commercial broadcast, and our guests are Nick Teddy and Tim Kettler from Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness. And we have on the telephone Dr. Ray Byersdorfer, and he spent 13 years in college earning bachelor's, master's, and PhD degrees, all in geology. His PhD is from the University of California, Davis. He's a professor of geology at the Department of Geological and Environmental Sciences at Youngstown State University in Ohio, where he has been on the faculty for 21 years. And Dr. Byersdorfer, thank you for being with us today.
Well, good morning, Mike, Nick, and Tim.
Now, the fracking, if you will, shale gas, many people have touted it as an economic boom for the communities that it's in, and a step towards energy independence. But there are also certainly environmental concerns that go along with it, and I would like to hear your perspective on shale gas.
Okay, very good. It's an economic boom for the oil companies because they pretty much don't have to pay for any of the environmental costs associated with doing it. And as far as independence, you know, what they're showing now is they're putting all these stations on the coast that are going to export the stuff to China. So we're risking sort of the health and an environment of local communities to be able to make oil company profits to then ship it overseas to where they'll get the highest prices. So there's a few things about shale gas, and I also want to focus in on injection wells. So which would you like me to start with?
Let's start with injection wells. We have one in place here in Coshocton County.
Okay, very good. As some of you listeners may know, we had a series of earthquakes in Youngstown related to the injection wells. And so that's sort of what perked my interest. You know, I'd known about them. I teach environmental geology, so they were part of my curriculum. But then it really hit home on the morning of March 17th, St. Patrick's Day of 2012, when we wound up getting 2011, when we wound up getting two earthquakes that morning related to the injection well. But we didn't know it at the time. At first, I was like, "Wow, earthquakes in Youngstown." You know, in terms of over 250 years of European settlement, we had never had an earthquake here. And then, so it was sort of, you know, interesting and exciting and a teachable moment. And then we continued to get the earthquakes. And turned out we had over 109 earthquakes from subsequent studies to show this. And 97 of them were sort of what instrumental, ones that were just detected by instruments. And sometimes, you know, going back and looking after the fact. But there were 12 that were called regional size earthquakes. And what they were due to was a company that had begun injecting waste from the shale gas industry, mostly from Pennsylvania, and they started injecting in December of 2010. Even back that summer, and when they were drilling that well, I got woken up in the middle of the night, difficulty breathing. I live maybe a mile and a half away from the well site, and the fumes, they had what was called sort of a blowout. They weren't able to control the natural formations, and some of the gases were coming out of the formations and polluting the air. And so we had to close all our windows. We don't have air conditioning, so we had to shut down the fans. And that turned out to be a precursor to what turned out to be, you know, a nightmare for many people in Youngstown. Now, the reason they started to do this and to start having a bunch of injection wells in on the sort of the Ohio-Pennsylvania border is because they're prohibited in Pennsylvania. And prior to this, what they were doing is they were just dumping the water just directly into creeks, and this is the flowback water from the fracking, which contains carcinogens, neurotoxins, bromides, as well as dissolved radioactive chemicals that are coming out of these ancient shale formations. And so they were either just treating it on the surface and then putting it into local creeks, or they were also just dumping it directly. And subsequent research showed that downstream of one of these oil and gas, shale gas waste centers on one of the rivers in Pennsylvania has shown that there's radioactive contamination 300 times greater than upstream, downstream of one of these sites. So, you know, I think it's safe to say that they were dumping, injecting low-level radioactive waste below Youngstown when they started to do that, because it's the same fluids that were coming from Pennsylvania. Now, in terms of injection wells, there's different types. And with the ones, they're sort of, you can look at whether the material is hazardous or non-hazardous. So there's some that are, you can have shallow wells that are injecting non-hazardous chemicals based on the composition of the actual fluids that are going in. They used to have hazardous shallow wells, but they banned those. There's also wells that they inject liquids to dissolve minerals. A lot of the salt that we get, particularly the salt that people eat, is they wind up injecting hot water, dissolving the salt underground, and then bringing it up. But the ones that deal with sort of waste or the deep ones are the class one, which are deep wells that are dealing with hazardous waste, and then class two, which have been defined as anything having to do with the oil and gas waste. So this waste could be hazardous or could be non-hazardous, but by definition, anything that the oil and gas companies produce is non-hazardous. That's why they'll call this stuff brine, saltwater injection well. Some of the trucks will say potable, non-potable water on them. And so these are, but again, it's just by definition. And I have this radical idea that something should be considered hazardous or non-hazardous based on what's in the liquids, not based on how they were produced, what industry produced it. So some of this stuff, if they were produced by a chemical company, an aluminum company, a steel mill, would be considered hazardous waste and have to be disposed of in Class 1 wells, which are much more restricted, versus if it's produced by the oil and gas industry, they basically get a pass, and then they can just inject it into these other wells. So what happened is this well started in December of 2010, and then we started to get the earthquakes in March. We continued to get a series of quakes, and they continued through the rest of the year. And then finally, in November or early December, the ODNR, Ohio Department of Natural Resources, had contracted with seismologists Dr. Kim and Dr. Armbruster from Columbia University to come and set up some remote stations to better pinpoint where exactly the earthquakes were occurring. And we had an earthquake on Christmas Eve of 2011, and that one they were able to pinpoint that exactly where the fault was, and that the what's called the focus of the earthquakes, and it was about 4,000 feet laterally and 2,500 feet below the bottom of the well, and it was about 2.2 to 2.3 miles below the surface. But they were able to pinpoint that it was happening in close proximity to the bottom of the well. Subsequent research showed that there's actually two faults, sort of parallel faults, what we call an echelon faults, and the liquids were actually migrating, and they could trace the earthquakes happening further and further away from the well as the fluids were migrating along these two faults. So the fault, you know, so the liquid being injected was acting as a lubricant. So these rocks were already under stress. There was a crack in the earth deep underground in very ancient, over a billion-year-old rocks that would have just stayed there and been, you know, been fine, and there would have been no earthquakes until it wound up getting triggered. So after the they shut the well down on December 30th, and then on December 31st, they wound up having the largest earthquake, and that quite often happens when there's a change that'll help the trigger. So either starting injecting or even stopping the injection. And then there was one a couple of weeks after that, and then they tapered off once they stopped doing it. They could also show that when they were shut down for a holiday, that the number of these micro-earthquakes diminished. So there was a clear correlation between the earthquakes and the injection of the fluids. And one of the frustrations that I had, well, several of them, is one of the frustrations is that looking at the timeline, you know, they're trying to say that it was just a bad operator, and it's true to a certain extent, because afterwards, and they started to dump the fluids illegally, and in fact, it was just came out in the paper yesterday that the CEO of the company is going to be going on federal trial in April 8th, but the employee that was ordered to do this has pleaded guilty and is cooperating with the prosecution, with the government prosecution, and he said that he was ordered to do this starting in December, I think December 12th of 2012. And so he actually, this guy was already starting to dump illegally before they even shut the well down. And then they continue to do that afterwards. But even backing up a little bit, again, the first earthquakes happened on March 17th, and on March 14th of 2011, the company had requested to get an increase in pressure, to increase the pressure at which they were pumping the fluids underground. March 16th, the permission was granted. We hadn't had any large earthquakes. I'm not sure if they had any smaller ones before then, but the very next day, they hadn't started to increase the pressure, but the very next day we had two earthquakes. And what happened, March 19th, you would have thought if they were a responsible company and if there was a regulators that actually had concerns for the safety of the community, they would have said, wait a minute, don't increase the pressure. But no, the company went right ahead and increased the pressure, but ODNR did nothing to actually try to cut down on that and say that we shouldn't, that they shouldn't be doing this. And what was interesting is by the fall, by like around Halloween of 2011, we had already had eight large-scale earthquakes in that region, and there was an article in the paper, the local papers, that did Bridewell trigger, they said six valley earthquakes, but it actually was higher than by that time, and there were quotes in that paper. One was from the company, and one was from the regulator, and I'll say those, and then let's see if you can figure out who was who. So someone said, there's no data linking the well to earthquakes, and the next one, quote, would said, has not seen any evidence that shows a correlation between localized seismic activity and deep injection well disposal. So which one's from the company and which one's from the regulators?
How much damage did the earthquakes cause? How severe were they?
They were not large. Only in the magnitude of around up to four. So they were not very large. Some people had cracks. And that was the main thing. So they weren't local damage. But could you answer my question? Who said which, right? There's no data linking the well to earthquakes. And the other one said, not seen any evidence that shows a correlation between localized seismic activity and deep injection wells disposal. This was sort of after we had eight large earthquakes, both of them pretty much denying that there was any connection between the two.
Not certain.
Okay, right. And isn't that a problem when you can't tell the company versus the regulator, right? They both were sounding exactly the same. Well, it was the company, the vice president for DNL said there's no data linking the wells to the earthquakes, but the ODNR, and it's actually ODNR, has not seen any evidence that shows a correlation between localized seismic activity and deep injection well disposal. That was Heidi Hetzel Evans, for the spokesperson for the ODNR. And that's where I have a problem. And by that point, there was a correlation. We had 250 years of European settlement in the area, never an earthquake. They started pumpings, and right after that we started getting earthquakes, so there was a correlation in time, and then the epicenters of the earthquakes were all in close proximity to the well, so there was a correlation in space. Again, that doesn't, covariance doesn't prove causality, but there definitely was a correlation in time and space to indicate that something needed to be checked out here.
Have there been similar?
That was one of the troubles that I had, yes.
Has there been similar situations elsewhere, or was Youngstown the first where it's believed that there's been a correlation between the wells and earthquakes?
Well, this, what's called sort of injection-induced seismicity, has been well known. It was first started actually in the 60s at the Rocky Flats Arsenal out in Colorado near Denver, where they were injecting waste underground. And then they started to trigger earthquakes in the Denver area. And so that was well determined back in the 60s. And then there had been other studies. There was one later on in an oil field in Colorado where they could monitor the pressure, and they knew how high the pressure needed to be to actually trigger the earthquakes. There was cases in Japan where they were trying to do this to get a better understanding of the faults. There was a case in Europe where they wanted to do deep hot rock, hot dry rock geothermal energy, and they wound up having too many induced earthquakes. They were injecting hot fluids underground, cold fluids, to heat them up to bring them back up, and they started triggering too many earthquakes. So no, this idea of sort of injection-induced seismicity has been well known. There's other ways. Mining operations can trigger earthquakes. Building a dam and a reservoir and the weight of the water behind the dam, as well as water seeping into rocks that are now submerged, has also, so there's something called reservoir-induced seismicity. So this idea of human-induced seismicity has been well known. So no, this wasn't a big surprise. It was just sort of, I think, a denial by both the company and, sadly, by the regulators at the time. But then, you know, to their credit, they did bring people in, and they did try to set up, be able to pinpoint it, and they were able to pinpoint it, and then they did shut down. They did shut down the well, and we have a local ban in, I think, 7 miles around the that site. And that 7 miles was picked to basically shut this company down. If you're 7.1 miles, it may or may not be safer. It really depends on in terms of the geology. And they were injecting over an interval of almost 1,000 feet, 980 feet of that bottom of the well. So there really wasn't any clue in terms of exactly where the fluids were going. And, you know, we have several hundred of these wells now, I think at least over 200 of these wells in Ohio. And Tom Tomasic from the ODNR, in my personal conversations with him, had said, you know, on a yearly basis, you know, 10 to 12 of those actually have leaking problems with the packers starting to leak, and usually they catch that. The problem is these Class 2 wells don't get inspected very frequently, whereas the Class 1 have much more restrictions on them. My local state representative has co-sponsored a bill to ban injection wells in Ohio, and also he wants a moratorium on this shale gas, and his name's Bob Hagan, and I support him on this ban of injection wells, and there's groups of people that are working towards that.
Well, thank you for being with us today. We need to take a break, and we'll come back, and we can talk more about shale gas extraction and injection wells. Our guest is Dr. Ray Byers-Dorfer, also Nick Teddy and Tim Kettler from Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness. We'll be back right after these words. And we are back. This hour is a paid commercial broadcast with Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness Incorporated. Nick Teddy and Tim Kettler here in the studio with us. And we have on the phone Dr. Ray Byers-Dorfer, professor of geology at Youngstown State University. And Ray, you wanted to share a little bit about your thoughts on shale gas.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. When you introduced me, you mentioned my degrees. Also, I wanted to interject some of my professional experience. Between my master's and PhD, I worked for Gulf Oil as an exploration geologist on the west coast of the U.S. So I did that for 3 years. And then I also, before I started my PhD, I was in Australia for a year at Monash University, where I had an SO research scholarship where we were looking at the alteration of some of the rocks in the Gippsland Basin, which at that time were producing 90% of Australia's oil. So I have about 4 years' experience, three for a company and one with the university related to the oil and gas exploration and development. Now, when I worked for Gulf Oil, you know, I had to go and present these plays, right, this idea of that we'd go and explore. And basically, I'd go and talk to the manager, and he wanted to know four things. There are four conditions you need to have an oil field. And one is that you need to have a source rock. That would be an organic rich rock, typically shale rock, that had the organic material that over time has matured into becoming the hydrocarbons. It's not dinosaurs. It's mostly sort of microscopic things that live in the oceans that wind up algae-type creatures in the oceans that settle and eventually die and decay. They need to have deep enough burial in order that they go through the chemical changes in order to become the oil or gas. And whether you get oil or gas, for the most part, it's related to temperature, and then also, the hotter it is, the more gas you would get, and also the type of organic matter. If the organic matter was more from an oceanic or marine setting, it would be more like oil, and then if it was from a continental setting, it would be more for gas. And then that stuff would actually start to migrate out of the source rock, and if there was enough with permeability, and it would go into a rock that was called a reservoir rock. So that would be the same as things that people drill into for their groundwater at deeper levels. These things would be filled not only with water, but also with oil and gas. And then it needs to be trapped. There's places where they'll have seeps where this stuff will migrate up to the surface, and so they need some sort of a trapping mechanism. And here in Ohio initially, and also over in Pennsylvania with Colonel Drake, the trapping was what is called an anticline, a type of fold that looks sort of like an A shape. like a big capital A, and that would be able to trap the rock, because it'd be an impermeable rock that would prevent it from going. And so those types of deposits have been around and discovered back in the 1800s, and they've been exploited for a long time. So those are the four things that I have to go through with the boss. And so what happened with shale gas typically had been considered the source rock. In fact, the Utica shale that people are excited about in Ohio has been the source rock for this Clinton formation that's been producing mostly gas and some oil since the 1970s. And so the Utica's 450 million years old, which I'll come back to, but it's been basically for hundreds of millions of years, it's been leaking hydrocarbons into the Clinton formation for a long time. But then starting in sort of the early noughties and really taking off around 2004, they started to figure out how they could go and extract the hydrocarbons directly from the shale, directly from the source rock. So not having to wait for nature to take millions of years for it to migrate into a reservoir where they could easily extract it, they started going in and exploiting the fact that some of these shale rocks already have some pre-existing cracks or zones of weakness that they could then go ahead and push under high pressure, blast those open essentially with this force of the fluids and leaving little grains of sand and other materials to prop them open, what they call proppants. So this started, and then the technology developed where they used to just drill straight down and then you could drill at an angle, and then they were able to figure out how to drill horizontally so they could go right through this, you know, shale layer and be able to then exploit this with this type of development. And so that started in the Barnett Shale, and if you look at sort of the records of the production there, it's around 2004 is really where it took off. So it's been only about a decade where they've been doing this type of shale gas combined with the horizontal drilling and this high pressure, high volume fracking that's been going on. So hearing people like the head of the ODNR Oil and Gas Division or the head of the ODNR saying, oh, we've been doing this in Ohio for 50 or 60 years is, you know, well, it's not a lie, but it's not technically true, because what's it? And what the shale gas it is this high pressure, high volume slick water material, which they haven't been doing for that long. In fact, they've only been doing it in the country where it developed, you know, only a little bit over a decade. And so that's been going on. Also, some of the concerns I have is I mentioned that here in Ohio we've had production for a long time. You know, they actually, you talk about Colonel Drake, but there was a salt well in, I think, out near Toledo that they actually discovered some oil and gas in the well. They weren't drilling for it. So the oil industry started around the same time in Ohio as they have done in Pennsylvania. And if you look at it, you know, there's been over 274,000 total number of wells drilled in Ohio that we know about. About 64,000 or more, say 65,000 or more, are currently active. But there's, again, over 200,000 of these sort of known inactive wells. But what's also scary is what wells that are called orphaned wells. There's estimated to be easily over 200,000 orphaned wells. These are wells that have been drilled. Maybe they were producing. Maybe they weren't. Maybe they were cased off, you know, plugged and abandoned. Maybe they weren't. They don't even know. They're unknown. And they've gone ahead and they have a program where they've sort of discovered and sealed up about 1,000 of those. But that still leaves, 200,000 of them. So we have close to, you know, 500,000 wells in Ohio. And one of the industry's own data shows that, you know, they drill the well and they put this decasing down, the steel pipe, and then they pump cement down the pipe and it comes out the bottom and it works its way back up the top to sort of act as a seal. It's not, you know, it's just to sort of plug in and seal it off. But industry's own data shows that about 6% of those cement jobs don't work, and they wind up having problems from the beginning. It's called sustained casing pressure, but it basically means the cement isn't getting a good seal up against this rock formation, and it's leaking. And then industry's own data shows that by the time a well is 30 years old, that there's a 50% chance that that well has going to have a problem. The cement has failed, and things can leak up the sides. So we have, you know, again, over 500,000 wells in Ohio that are potential pathways for contamination to get up and contaminate people's water. So we have this whole legacy that hasn't been taken into account. And even if that wasn't a problem, another concern I have is research from Colorado has shown, and this was from a couple years ago, has shown that during the 7 days when they're doing this frack job, where they're pumping this, you know, 5 to 8 million gallons of liquids, including tens of thousands of gallons of highly toxic chemicals, that when during that 7 days or so when they're doing that frack job, people that are living within a half mile of that fracking well are getting exposed through the air of hazardous levels of neurotoxins and carcinogens. And so that's even if nothing goes wrong. Also, research that just was released about a week ago from Colorado is now showing that there's actually a correlation between birth defects and proximity to shale gas wells. There's also data from Pennsylvania that has been done by two different studies, some economists and then also an environmental scientist from Cornell, and has shown, and this is still in the early stages, has shown a correlation between low birth weight in babies and proximity in Pennsylvania to shale gas wells. So there's, you know, even if nothing goes wrong, there's evidence that that there's could be sort of health, severe health impacts, particularly to you know, sort of pregnant women that have babies that are trying to develop and having all of these issues getting due to exposures. There's also been well-documented cases, places like Dimmick, Pennsylvania, and Pavilion, Wyoming, and in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, where the groundwater has been documented to have been contaminated due to this shale gas development.
And what are you calling for legislation? What's the solution, I guess, to these issues?
Well, right now, I think we need a moratorium. And, you know, I'm not against shale. You know, it'd be like saying I'm against sandstone or I'm against limestone. But basically, the industry got a free pass. You know, the 2005 energy bill exempted this whole thing, you know, what's called the Halliburton loopholes, which are documented. And there's now laws being proposed. Several of them, they call it the Frack Pack, that are going through Congress to try to take back these loopholes. So I've heard industry sort of people saying, oh, the Halliburton loophole is a myth. But basically, this industry has been exempt from the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Protection Act, the Superfund, and laws. There's about seven of them that they were exempt from. So they were able to basically exempt this whole technique. What's also troubling is here in Ohio, that basically took care of sort of the liquids in the air issues, Clean Air Act, Clean Drinking Water, Safe Drinking Water Act, Clean Water Act. But here in Ohio, you know, these drill cuttings, particularly because they're going down and drilling into this 450-million-year-old shale formation. Now, shales wind up getting uranium in them. In fact, when they were developing the whole nuclear bomb program during World War II, they were using shale to extract uranium. Not totally, but they were using that. So it has uranium in it. Uranium is radioactive, as everybody knows, and it undergoes radioactive decay, eventually becoming lead. But there's a whole bunch of steps along the way, including radon, which is a gas, which if it can get into your homes get into your lungs, can cause lung cancer, and then also radium. Now, radium is dissolved in the liquid, and it winds up that it behaves similar to calcium in terms of its size and charge. It sort of mimics calcium, and as most people know, you know, calcium is part of our bones. So, unfortunately, this radium can get into the waters and also get into people's bones. But so it's going to be coming back in the flowback water, but it's also still in some of these drill cuttings. And the budget that they passed in Ohio this past summer exempted this material. These drill cuttings have been not only exempted, they've defined them as beneficial material, meaning that they can spread them on farmers' fields, they can use them in landfills as, again, it's shale, it's normally impermeable, they can use it as a seal or a liner in landfills, even though, you know, regardless of it has radioactivity. We had a problem where, you know, not all of the landfills even have detectors, but we had a problem here in the Youngstown area where this truck came and it set the detector off. It had drill cuttings. In fact, it was from the same darn company that triggered all the earthquakes. And then the truck left, and then it came back and tried to get in again, and it checked it off. And now they have no idea where it went. And so it was, you know, it had this low-level radioactive waste that was more than likely illegally dumped somewhere. I talked to the person in charge of our waste program in our county, and he was saying, I'm going to try to figure it out. And I kept checking in with him, and he never was able to. So I have no idea where this material went. So that also exempts the the drill cuttings from this. And so basically, you know, what's happening is we have corporate profits. These corporations that are doing this have wound up now putting all the expense on the burden of the citizens, right? Public cost, yet private profit. And some of you may, listeners may have heard, there's just been over in Pennsylvania, there's one of these wells that have exploded, and they're saying missing, right? One of the workers, more than likely killed during the explosion, and they're still going and trying to put it out now. It's going to take several days to put it out. In fact, injuries, fatalities in the oil and gas industry have increased significantly since we've had this boom in shale gas development. And you know what's interesting? When I started reading about those reports, you would think like things like explosions would be the main reason why you'd have increased fatalities, but it wasn't. That was number three. Then you would think maybe getting hit on the head by a pipe or the traveling block during the drilling operation. No, that was number two. The number one cause of the fatalities is traffic accidents, vehicular accidents. And part of the reason for that is that the oil and gas industry has been exempt from all the highway safety laws for over 50 years. So not only are they exempt in terms of the water, the air, the solid drill cuttings here in Ohio, also the whole industry is exempt from the normal rules that other truck drivers, again, any other industry would have to follow these rules, but they don't have to in terms of inspections and maintenance on the vehicles. They're exempt from that.
Dr. Beiersdorfer, we need to get to we're running out of time. We need to get to a commercial here soon, and I want to leave a few minutes for Nick and Tim. What else would you like to share with our listeners today? What would be the takeaway? What message would you like to share with us?
Well, what the people in Youngstown are doing is they're putting on amending their city charter to say that they have a right to clean air and clean water. And as citizens, they can prevent toxic polluting industries from coming into their community. It's called the Citizens Bill of Rights, and it's with sort of an organization called CELDEF is helping to sponsor that. They passed a ban on injection wells in Mansfield. Broadview Heights has one of these bans. Oberlin has also passed one of these. And so citizens need to take back local control. They all need to get more active in their local government and say that, look, we have a right to keep these toxic industries out of our communities. Now, they passed a law, a state law, preempting this to say, banning, you have no local control. But they had a similar law in Pennsylvania that was proved to be unconstitutional. So people need to organize, your community would need to get together, and they should try to get a ban, and they do need to have one of these outright bans. If they try to do it with zoning regulations, they wind up in court, and they typically lose. They need to, the city of Pittsburgh did the same thing. They need to have an outright ban in terms of doing this. They need to protect themselves, because what we've seen is the regulators have basically been captured by the industry, and they're not doing anything to protect the citizens. They're basically protecting the companies.
There is a local event coming up on May the 17th, and we will be back once again with Nick Teddy and Tim Kettler to talk about just that. Dr. Beiersdorfer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
That's Dr. Ray Beiersdorfer, professor of geology at Youngstown State University. We'll be back once again right after these words. And we are back one more time with our final segment of our paid commercial broadcast with Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness Incorporated. And we are back once again with Nick Teddy and Tim Kettler. And Tim, there was one issue that Ray didn't get to. I know you wanted to address.
Yes, and not to heap more on the pile for folks to think about, but there is one more issue, and that's water usage. In my industry, the wastewater industries, we're very sensitive to our role as water recyclers. In the face of what we're already seeing changes in global climate and the way we as consumers use water, farming in areas that were formerly arid and were not utilized for farming, and we're at the point now where the Colorado River ends before it can even reach its former terminus in the Gulf of California, why some 75 miles from where it used to run. So water usage is up, and looking at these areas where they're particularly depleted is in the same areas where so much of this type of technology is being employed. It takes 5 million gallons, conservatively, to frack a well one time. Technology permits up to 18 fracks. So 18 times 5 million conservatively over a projected total number of wells on the Utica Shale of roughly 19,000. Doing the math, which I can't do in my head, that's a heck of a lot of water. And this isn't just water that's permanently removed from our water cycle. It's water that's being turned into toxic waste that we must deal with. And that's our legacy at this point. And it's not a legacy that I think that we can all feel comfortable with.
Just got a couple of minutes left. You've got an event coming up on May the 17th. Can you tell us about it one more time, please?
Yes, we're going to have a number of community service organizations tabling this event. It'll be an 8-hour event at the Coshocton Village Inn. We're going to have people from around Ohio who have been affected by shale development speaking, and we will have people who are in mature shale plays coming into Ohio and talking too. We've also got Bill Baker coming up on a program here in March. He'll be doing just what Dr. Beersdorfer did. Bill is an organizer with NoFrack Ohio Coalition, and he was instrumental in organizing the ban in Mansfield against injection wells and the Community Bill of Rights. We also have a website. It is SECAware.org. It's SECAware.org, and we're just getting that established, and we would like people to visit that. There'll be more details there about our upcoming program.
All right, very good. Thank you both for being with us today. That's Nick Teddy and Tim Kettler from Coshocton Environmental and Community Awareness Incorporated, and also Dr. Ray Beiersdorfer. And that is our time for the morning.